The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation comes from Chairman and CEO of Eli Lilly and Company, David Ricks.
I'm very pleased to introduce our guest speaker today, Dave Ricks. Over the course of Indiana's 202-year history, there is no corporation that has been more important to our state than Eli Lilly and Company. Lilly is one of the largest corporations and charitable benefactors in Indiana. Today, Lilly has more than 38,000 employees worldwide, including more than 11,000 right here in Indiana. Lilly has offices in 18 countries and markets its products in more than 120 countries. Currently, the 141-year-old company, about to turn 142, is in a transition. Many of its top-selling products have lost patent exclusivity over the past decade. Our speaker today, Dave Ricks, will lead Lilly into its next chapter through new product development, promising research, increased productivity, and attracting top scientific talent from around the world. A 20-year Lilly veteran, Dave is chairman and chief executive officer at Lilly, an organization he first joined as a business development associate in 1996. Dave held several management roles in marketing and sales in both the U.S. and Canada, and has worked his way steadily through the corporate ranks, including serving as general manager of Lilly Canada, the head of Lilly China, one of the world's fastest-growing emerging markets, and serving as the president of Lilly USA, the company's largest affiliate. Before taking the reins as president and CEO, he most recently led Lilly Biomedicines. Dave has been CEO since January 1st, 2017, and took on the additional role of chairman on June 1st in that same year. He earned a Bachelor of Science from Purdue University in 1990 and an MBA from Indiana University in 1996. Dave serves on the board of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, PhRMA, the Adobe Board of Directors, and the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership. He also chairs the Riley Children's Foundation Board of Governors. With extensive experience in Lilly's commercial operations, along with an appreciation and understanding of research and development, Dave has the knowledge and energy to lead through this period of challenging patent expirations and exciting new growth. We are fortunate to have Lilly in Indiana, and we're fortunate to have Dave with us today. Please join me in welcoming Dave Ricks.
Thank you, Claire. Fun. Appreciate that. Thank you, Claire, for that kind introduction, and congratulations on completing your term successfully.
Thanks.
It's best to be the ex-chair, usually. It's an honor to be invited to speak with you today. This group, the Economic Club, does such important work, bringing leaders together from across our city and state and identifying and then solving problems. Many of my predecessors at Lilly have stood here before me, Randy Tobias, Sidney Terrell, John Lechleiter. So let me take a moment to thank them. Without their leadership, Lilly wouldn't be where it is today. And without them, I wouldn't be where I am today. Each of them have been mentors and friends for me during my career. Hopefully, my comments today live up to the standard, the high standard, they've set in years past. Let me also take a moment to thank my wife, Chris, who's in the audience today. I don't know where she is, but hi, hon. Without her, I wouldn't be here either. She's a great support, having moved her family around the world, as was described. She's my best friend and is an awesome mom as well. As Claire said, I've been with the company for more than 20 years, and that's long enough to come to understand Lilly's proud history of participating in collaborative efforts, like the Economic Club, to make Indiana better. This tradition goes all the way back to Colonel Eli Lilly himself, who played a founding role in what is now called the Indy Chamber. Over the years, Lilly family members were deeply engaged in making Indianapolis and Indiana better places to work and live. And of course, all of us have benefited from their commitment to our state. And their tradition continues today. Lilly remains quite active philanthropically and in the community. We're proud that we just raised $15 million for the United Way in the most recent campaign. That's a record. Yet even more than the money, Lilly people serve on boards and as volunteers at countless organizations around our city and state. In fact, the very first president of the Economic Club was Tom Lake. Tom was the president of Lilly during the 70s, and after he retired, he served another 15 years as president and chairman of the Lilly Endowment. I know several of our colleagues from the endowment are here today as well. Tom's philanthropic spirit was born during his childhood in a coal mining community. When the Great Depression hit, Tom's family and their neighbors didn't wait for help from the outside. Instead, they banded together and helped each other. Tom later recalled, "You were looked upon as being somewhat unusual if you weren't doing something to help others." His attitude lives on throughout Indiana and inside Lilly. We at Lilly want to do something to help because this, Indiana, is our home. As our home, the health of Indiana is critical to the health of Lilly. And without Indiana and Indianapolis, Lilly simply couldn't do what it does today. Only when our community does well do we do well. In fact, I would argue Lilly has benefited over 141 years and almost a week to 142 from being headquartered here in Indiana rather than on the coast like our peers. This is a stable place in which to operate, and it's a nice place to live. When we recruit people, they tend to stay. And workforce stability in our business, which is a long-term planning business, is a critical strategic advantage. Being isolated from our peers has some drawbacks, but some advantages as well. It's helped us avoid distractions and fads so we can focus on our work, again, long-term work, to help patients get better medicines. So without the benefits of Indiana, Lilly would not be in the strong position we find ourselves today. In my remarks today, I plan to cover three key things: the status of our business, the strengths and some deficiencies in our city and state and how we can build upon them, and then I'd like to comment on Lilly's new focus as it relates to what we plan to do to help build our home and ask for your help in doing so. So today, Lilly's business is strong. Claire described the changes the company's been through, starting in the later part of the last decade, preparing for a period where the two largest products in our company's history would be losing their patents within 3 years' time. During that period, we called it the years YZ, and the company did lose a meaningful part of our revenue and income. But my predecessor, John Lechleiter, made a key bet, which is to bet on innovation, invest in our own labs, and grow our way out of this problem. And today, we've successfully navigated that period, and we're in a period we call execute for growth. Our leadership team is also focused on the next period, which is what we call next level performance. How can we grow beyond the current aspirations we have? Today, our growth is driven by 9 new product launches since 2014. That's also a record for the company. These products include Trulicity for diabetes, continuing our proud heritage of helping patients who suffer from diabetes. It's a once weekly formulation that controls blood sugar. It includes a product called Lartruvo, which is the first new medicine in over 40 years for soft tissue sarcoma, imparting up to a 1-year survival benefit to patients. It includes other cancer medications like Cyramza for stomach, liver, and colorectal cancer, and Verzenio, most recently approved for metastatic breast cancer. By the end of this year, we expect our new portfolio to roughly equal the size of revenue of the second largest medical products company in the state, Zimmer Biomet. This is from just zero in 2014. We have literally reinvented our company in that period of time. And we've got a lot more to come. As many as six more launches in the next 18 months in the United States. We're on a cascade here, shown in this slide, of what we call the 20 and 20 in 10, which means we'll launch 20 new brands with 20 additional indications over the course of 10 years, an unprecedented level of R&D output and productivity for our company or any company our size in the sector. And we're not stopping there. We have initiatives underway to speed up R&D by 5 years. That's cutting in half the time it takes to go from preclinical to a patient. We've already achieved two of those 5 years, and we're focused on knocking off the next three. We're ramping up our use of digital technology to engage customers in new ways. Transformation has enabled our return to growth. Yet, as we built our new leadership team in my first year as CEO, we realized that to reach our full potential and to ensure long-term high performance for Lilly, we had to make some difficult decisions, even amongst what was a pretty good moment for the company. As many of you know, we're deciding today on the best path forward for our Elanco Animal Health subsidiary. We've invested heavily in this business, and today Elanco, based in Greenfield, Indiana, is a top-tier, globally competitive animal health company. Our goal is to maximize the value of this asset and put Elanco on the strongest possible path forward for its future. This could mean an IPO as an independent company, a merger or combination with another animal health company, or it could mean retaining it in Lilly. We are on schedule to conclude this analysis by this July, and we'll make some announcements at that time. More broadly, Lilly launched a comprehensive productivity agenda. This involves some difficult choices and cost-saving initiatives across the company, including reducing our workforce by 3,500 employees, roughly 10%. This was mainly through a voluntary early retirement program here in the U.S. Lilly has so many opportunities, we have to find ways to focus our resources on the very best of them. That's how good organizations become great. Lilly realizes that the future will require a different organization than its past. We face a future in which the amount governments, employers, and individuals are willing to pay for healthcare, let alone their medicines, is not going to grow. This means that Lilly and the rest of the healthcare industry needs to become significantly more efficient. At the same time, the pace of innovation in our industry has picked up rapidly, to the point where now new medicines are rendering older drugs obsolete well before their patents expire. This is great news for patients. More choices, more cures. But it does put pressure on our business model. So we've slimmed down our organization in order to get in fighting shape to face these pressures. The future requires Lilly to be faster and more nimble. The future also requires Lilly to be more attuned to the outside world. That's one reason we've stepped up our efforts to be a magnet for talent. Technical talent, diverse talent from around the world. We've set aspirational goals last year to increase the number of women and minorities in management roles. We're seeing good progress there. We've sent well over 1,000 managers, including myself, to something we call inclusion training, so that all of our employees, no matter where they are from, what they look like, what their background is, or how old they are, can feel comfortable bringing their whole selves to a big corporation to work. Diverse ideas are the fuel of innovation, and they are critical to our forward success. So Indiana is in a similar position to Lilly, I would say, in many ways stronger than ever. Since I first came here while attending Purdue as a freshman to Indianapolis, I can say we've made a lot of progress since 1986. Our downtown is revitalized completely. We've built great community assets like the Monon Trail, the Culture Trail. We've got a vibrant food scene downtown. Our higher education systems in the state continue to get better and better. Purdue, IU, and Notre Dame are all world-class research universities. And we have a robust private liberal arts college system, and I need to add also an outstanding small engineering school in Rose Holman in Terre Haute. And Ivy Tech has grown into its role as the state's community college. What got us here? Well, we call it the Indiana way. Indiana has a great tradition of collaborative problem solving between business and community leaders. And we don't wait for the public sector to fix things. Instead, we regularly come together with politicians and say, let's get this done. Business and community leaders don't like to be told what to do in Indiana. But we are incredibly willing to rise above our own interests to help our community. That's the Indiana way. When Indianapolis leaders wanted to convince the NBA to bring the All-Star game here in a few years, Larry Bird himself drove an Indy car down Fifth Avenue. He fit in it somehow. He delivered our bid to NBA headquarters. You know, I recently heard the NBA commissioner, Adam Silver, say this, that no other city he sees in the U.S. pulls its private sector together quite like Indianapolis to make things happen. That's the Indiana way. Yet as we've learned at Lilly, even great traditions need to be changed, to be challenged, to address new problems. As successful as Indianapolis and Indiana have been, we still have big challenges ahead of us. First, many of the strengths and strategies that have powered Indiana's past success aren't competitive enough today. Second, while Indiana offers top quality health care, education, and economic opportunities, too few Hoosiers benefit from them. Economically, Indiana has grown jobs at nearly twice the rate of the rest of the Midwest, and that's something to be proud of. But that growth is concentrated almost exclusively around Indianapolis. Since the year 2000, all of the job growth in the state has happened in the Indianapolis region, while the rest of the state has actually collectively lost jobs over the last two decades. In education, I mentioned Indiana has world-class universities, yet we also have many struggling public schools at the K-12 level. This slide compares math scores of the average student in Indiana school districts against the average of students nationally, with some districts seeing their average student scores below 3/4 of all students nationally. That's simply not good enough to help Indiana compete, nationally or internationally, for jobs and business investment. In healthcare, we have the nation's largest medical school at IU. We have some of the nicest hospitals and excellent surgery centers. Yet Indiana ranks 38th among states for overall health status. As a result, Hoosiers living just a few miles apart can have dramatically different lives. As you can see on this slide, which is based on data from the IU Fairbanks School of Public Health, the average person living at the south end of the Monon Trail can expect to die 14 years sooner than the average person living on the north end in Carmel. So if you're in Carmel, life expectancy is like living in Switzerland. At the south end of the trail, actually the zip code where Lilly is headquartered, life expectancy is similar to Bangladesh. Why are these disparities a problem? After all, we all believe in freedom of choice, self-determination. We could say these disparities exist because some people don't take advantage of the opportunities in our community. But here's why we shouldn't say that. First, we know so much of a person's life trajectory is set in childhood, long before any of us are making choices for ourselves. I believe it's simply unjust not to help reverse the negative impacts children suffer through no fault of their own. Secondly, an unequal community is a weak and unstable community. The most competitive cities globally are competitive because they take full advantage of all their people. They don't leave anything behind. Third, this is a basic issue of neighborliness. To get to the Lilly headquarters, myself and my colleagues drive through these neighborhoods, and it's clearly visible that they're struggling. So I propose this, that to address these gaps, we need to rev up the Indiana way. So as we watch Indy cars zip around the Indianapolis Motor Speedway later this month, let's adopt the same competitive mindset as these racing teams. They don't come here to drive around the track. They come here to measure themselves against the best and win. If we want to be competitive at attracting people and companies, we as Hoosier leaders need to constantly look outside our state and see how we're doing against the best in the nation, the best in the world. Think about this for a minute. How many times do you hear graduates of IU talking about how much better their school is than Purdue? Or vice versa. That happens too, Suresh. I'm a graduate of both schools, so I can say this. It is possible to have two great state universities in one state. We need to spend our energy comparing IU against Michigan or Purdue against Cal rather than thumping our chest about who's best in Indiana. Also, just like IndyCar teams, we can use the power of data to help us zero in on the roots of problems and prevent us from reaching our full potential. Each car at the 500 track has 200 sensors in it, sending back a constant stream of data about how the car is performing, identifying sources of lagging performance in the car and the engine, even the driver, and making adjustments on the fly to improve it. Data is the electricity of the 21st century. It will power our future. If we want to compete as well as in this century as we did in the last, we need to harness the digital revolution in every way. I chair the Riley Children's Foundation, and for months now we've been working with researchers at the Eye School of Medicine and Riley Hospital to identify and study the underlying causes of infant mortality in our state. Not launching new programs at this, but analyzing and understanding the problem. Today in our state, a baby dies every 14 hours before its first birthday. This is about two times as much as the best states in the country, and that's a tragedy. For me, this is a litmus test issue for our state. If we can't help moms keep their babies alive for their first year, we have no hope of tackling the other problems they'll face in their life. This is why we applaud Governor Holcomb's bold goal for Indiana, which is to lower infant mortality in our state from the seventh worst nationally to the best in the Midwest by 2024. Riley and the IU Med School have found that just 3% of all zip codes in the state account for 27% of infant death. And nearly half of those zip codes are in Indianapolis. Using insights from this data, officials from the state government, IU hospitals, other regional hospitals are working together to formulate a plan. We need to put this plan in action, and all of us here need to support it. So these tools, a competitive mindset, data analysis, can rev up the Indiana way. They can help us solve our biggest problems and seize our largest opportunities. So how's Lily thinking about our role in the community going forward? We've been thinking a lot about it, and I'd like to talk to you about that now. We think the most important areas for action and where we spend our time outside of making new medicines is on our economy here, the education system, and in healthcare. So we're shifting our community engagement and philanthropy to these areas because we think this is where we can make the biggest difference in Indiana's future. In our economy, Indiana has developed a tech cluster most in this region would covet, as evidenced by the increased venture capital investment over the last decade. This is also true in life sciences, which is anchored by some large companies like ours, Roche, Cook, Dow Agro, Zimmer, and others, complemented by many smaller firms also increasing venture capital investment. But if the past decade or so was about building up each of these sectors, the opportunity for the future is to converge them. This is already happening. Among my healthcare peers, one of the hottest topics is how artificial intelligence from digital technology can transform medical research and possibly even replace health services in our healthcare system. And this is not just about healthcare. A recent McKinsey analysis predicts that data analytics, including artificial intelligence, will add $15 trillion of global growth every year across 19 traditional sectors, including consumer goods, banking, logistics, etc. This is why Lilly's participating in projects like 16 Tech, because by co-locating people from across companies, across sectors, And across the state, we can create advances that apply to all of our businesses, all of our sectors. The initial focus of the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute, or IBRI, which is also the anchor tenant of 16 Tech, are digital analytics and metabolic diseases like diabetes. At Lilly, we've made digital technology a key part of our future strategy. We're also starting with diabetes. Lilly has partnered with other companies to link up digital apps, blood sensors, and new delivery systems like automated pumps and pens to a system we call connected care. The goal here is to help people with diabetes solve the health challenges they face, to control their disease, to adhere to medications, and better understand how their disease is operating with the medicines they're taking, how they're responding to treatment. This is the first set of partnerships for us with tech companies, and we hope there are many, many more. Of course, an advanced economy also requires highly educated workers. To that goal, Lilly has been continuing to be active in working to expand the pre-K access across our state. We also continue to support compelling new models in the K through 12 grades, including charter schools, innovation schools, and career academies. But a big gap remains, and that is in STEM achievement. Effective STEM learning motivates problem solving, creativity, and innovation, all things our state needs, regardless of the field you work in, but certainly in our field, it's important. According to ACT scores, shown on this slide, too few high schoolers in Indiana are graduating ready to pursue a path toward a STEM career. You can see Massachusetts, the national leader, well ahead of nearly every subgroup in our state. As a result, the supply of STEM-qualified workers woefully lags the demand of our growing tech, life science, and advanced manufacturing sectors, as you can see on this slide. There have been some good private efforts to improve this situation, including our own. But we won't get where we want as a state unless the state government gets more involved. If we don't have a state strategy for STEM, we don't have a strategy for STEM. We need to have a STEM to become part of the curriculum for every student in our state every day of the school year. And to reach that goal, we need the state government to help provide a path, funding, curricular support, and teacher training. I know the state DOE has been working on the strategy, and that's good, but we also need a full commitment to put that strategy into action. I think we need this now. Finally, let me talk about health. Health is to Indiana what real estate costs are to San Francisco and poor infrastructure is to the Northeast. It cancels out many of our area's greatest benefits, like low cost of living and a low tax base. This should be of especially concerning to employers, because commercial insurance pays higher prices to healthcare providers to make up for low payments from public insurance programs. So even if your employees are healthy, you're still bearing the costs of poor statewide health. As a state, we must be willing to take action on the things we know will improve the situation. One of those issues is smoking. This is a problem for Indiana that demands action. There are some good proposals out there that could improve the situation and do it rapidly. We say let's get these done. Two other interrelated challenges are diabetes and obesity. For employers, the average adult with diabetes consumes more than twice as much health care as someone without diabetes. For governments, that higher spending on health care requires higher taxes or lower spending on things like schools and infrastructures, which I think we'd all agree are key priorities. One in three Hoosiers are obese. This is the eighth worst in the country. And even one-third of Hoosier middle schoolers and high schoolers are overweight, which puts them at risk for adult obesity and diabetes. To help address this problem, we announced last week that we're partnering with earlier this week, with the IU Fairbanks School, with Eskenazi Health, and community organizations to bring down the especially high incidence of diabetes in three key Indianapolis neighborhoods. Poor health outcomes are depressing lifespans in these neighborhoods, as I mentioned earlier. There are many issues that contribute to poor health outcomes. We certainly don't have all the answers. But we do think we can apply what we've learned from doing similar projects in other low-income communities in other countries. And hopefully we can create a model that can help reduce the incidence of diabetes all across Indiana. So these are the three areas we at Lilly are focusing our community efforts on. But these are challenges far bigger than any one company can hope to tackle. They're even too big for government to solve on its own. We need the cross-sector collaboration we've always used here in Indiana. So I'd like to challenge all of us as Hoosier leaders, especially my colleagues in the business community, to rev up the Indiana way. Let's work together with a more competitive mindset, with the power of data, to make our Indiana, our home, a better place. A better place for people like Patrice Duckett. She's a lifelong resident in the Northwest Indy neighborhood, one of the communities where the diabetes program we just spoke about will operate. Patrice is here in the audience today, and you can read about her story on the displays, which are right here on my right. Patrice has seen her neighborhood go from a bustling, prosperous community to one where local businesses struggle. Now, with her skills as a neighborhood center director and community organizer, she's deeply involved in efforts to revitalize it with new housing, a new school, a new park, and walking paths. Patrice is a single mom of two kids and wants them to get a good education right where they live, not by moving somewhere else. She suspects she's pre-diabetic herself, yet her long work hours make it hard to get to the clinic. She knows all about the importance of healthy eating and regular exercise, but there are real barriers where she lives to achieving these goals. It's hard to find fresh produce. It's not easy to exercise. But she said this: "I love my community and my people. In order for me to be successful, in order for my children to have a future, I have to do something." And you know what? She's right. We all love our community, yet to continue to be successful in the future, we have to do something, something more. All of us as business leaders can step up our engagement in our community. All of us should invest in our Indiana home, in all its parts and all its people, because working on our community is part of winning in business. At Lilly, we're celebrating our strengths as a company, but we're also taking a hard look at areas we can improve. Let us, all of us in this room, do the same in our community. Let's celebrate our proud traditions, our many strengths, our past successes. But let's also take a hard look at the distribution of those successes. That's what will take Indiana from being a leader in the Midwest to being a leader, period. So let's work together to make our Indiana home a great place for everyone. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dave. That was a really insightful presentation. Thanks, with a lot of ground that you covered. Really appreciate it. Well, I'm going to start on a topic that I don't think I heard you address, but I told you I'd ask you about it.
Right.
And that's a hot topic, which is the price of pharmaceutical products. No secret that the pharma sector is under fire from folks who would like to see lower prices, especially for people on a fixed income or who have maybe high deductible health plans. And President Trump has said on several occasions that we're letting pharma companies get away with murder when it comes to prices. So can you help us understand what is behind the high cost, if you agree with that statement, of pharmaceutical products?
Yeah, thanks for the question. That's obviously one we get a lot. Look, it's no doubt an issue. I think it's one of the bigger issues we have as a business is both helping patients afford their medications, at the same time invest in more medicine. Something else I think most people agree we should have is more solutions. And it's a difficult balance. So a couple of facts, and then we can talk about what we've been doing about it. So first of all, in the U.S., medications make up about 15%, 1/5, of all healthcare expenditures. That's a surprise to a lot of people. People think it's more, and they think that for a good reason, which is that consumer out-of-pocket costs for healthcare are not balanced across the type of healthcare you consume. So if you go to the hospital, typically you pay about 5%. If you buy a medicine at the pharmacy counter, you're paying about 25% of the cost. So our insurance system, our health systems are designed actually to subsidize certain parts of healthcare versus others. That's an issue, and I think that needs to be addressed. We think using medications can be one of the most patient-friendly but also successful ways to treat chronic disease. Why are we biasing reimbursement against it? Also, it's important to note the U.S. spends more than any other country on healthcare, almost 20% of our GDP, and that's why I say I don't think that number's going to grow. We better become more efficient. So efficiency has to be part of the answer. But everything in healthcare in the U.S. is more expensive. Actually, the U.S. ranks about in the middle of OECD countries in terms of how much of the healthcare dollar goes to medications. So we're not high on our medication spending relative to the rest of the base of healthcare. That also surprises people. So cardiac surgeries, inpatient, everything is costing more. But again, the patients are bearing a higher percent of this cost. There are more acute problems than others with medication costs. I think in particular, you mentioned high deductible plans, a growing trend employers use, many in this room probably, we have a high deductible plan, used to control healthcare costs. But if control of costs is based on rationing medications, that's probably leading to more costs later. So take diabetes. If someone has to skip medications because of out-of-pocket costs, that's going to result in an emergency room visit or some other cost appearing in the system. That's not smart. We need to adopt new policies around how medications get reimbursed. Mm-hmm. Medications that were not meant to be used sporadically, but chronically for life, and take away these financial penalties for being sick. You know, Scott Gottlieb, who's the new FDA commissioner, I think said it well at a recent hospital conference, saying we've created an insurance reimbursement system where the sick are subsidizing the well. And that is what we have. Premiums are relatively flat and low in most public exchanges and other measures of that. But for the sick, out-of-pocket costs are rising. We need to reverse that trend. So we've got a lot of ideas about that. We can talk about pricing for value, making sure that the right policies are in place for chronic medications, building high-deductible plans that have the right incentives to keep people on a medication from December to January. Just because your deductible resets doesn't mean you shouldn't go off the you should go off the medication. So all those are areas we're active in.
That's really helpful to understand. And part of it's also that it takes a long time to develop a drug, although you're working on
speeding that up. Which
and
is
then,
part of the efficiency. So 10 years and about $2 billion per drug.
And not every molecule ends up being a commercial product.
That's right. And the $2 billion includes that cost of failure.
Okay. Well, I came across a report from a Wells Fargo analyst just from this week who covers the pharma sector, and he had a piece that argued that drug companies in the U.S. are on a long-term arc toward price controls and lower margins. And he goes on to say that arguments about the cost, such as what we were just talking about, and supply chain constituents are not compelling to the person who's standing at the pharmacy counter trying to weigh, do I buy groceries or do I pay for my drug? So I'm curious what your take is on that analyst perspective.
I hope he's wrong, and not just for our company, but for the future of medical innovation. If we think about what's happened in the last 20 years, we've made dramatic progress against significant diseases. We have a cure for hepatitis C. We've made AIDS a chronic disease. We've made breast cancer a chronic disease. I don't think anyone wants to see that stop, and that is all enormously expensive and risky, as you pointed out. So the promise of an intellectual property period where you can be rewarded for that 1 in 1,000 discovery that comes out of the labs, I think has to be there, or people won't invest in this business. They won't invest in new medicines. At the same time, I think he's right about those explanations not being satisfying if you're standing there with your kid and you can't afford the medication they were just prescribed. I think we can do better as a country than this, though. And that's why we spend a lot of time in Washington with policymakers trying to adjust the role of the federal government, which plays a role because they make markets in a number of the healthcare programs. We expect actually some news a week from today from the president and Secretary Azar on this. And you know, we are for market principles. We do want to see prices come down for consumers, but without sacrificing what everyone wants as well, which is new innovations.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, your former employee, the Secretary Azar, did announce, I think yesterday or the day before, that he was helping to advise the President on a new plan. So is Lilly involved? Yeah, I'm sure he is. Is Lilly involved in that? Is Pharma, you sit on the board of Pharma as well, involved in those conversations and advising the administration?
Of course, yeah. We have a stake in this, and as I said, we think the system should be adapted and changed. We are for progressing the healthcare system toward more value-based reimbursement in general. So let the product or the service that delivers value win. Reward that, not everything else. And that's an enormous problem in healthcare today. But also just simple things like ensuring that chronic medications are not disadvantaged at the pharmacy counter versus hospital stay or emergency room or other forms of reimbursement. So we're actively lobbying. We're just one voice. Others have different views. Mm-hmm. And we'll have to see next week what happens and going forward. I do want to stress, though, for our company, our tide doesn't rise and fall solely on this issue. I mean, our products are valuable. We know that because people pay for them and consume them. There are problems with that today. But for a lot of people, it works. And in a lot of foreign markets, which is half of Lilly's business, they're in a different discussion about many of these things. So for those who have worried about the future of the company, you know, we think we've got an answer, which is keep innovating, diversify the business around the world, and advocate for policies that we think make sense.
Great, thank you. Well, let's shift gears. You talked a little bit about your exciting diabetes initiative. I thought maybe we could spend a few moments talking about Lilly Foundation. And first, maybe clarifying for our audience the difference between Lilly Company Foundation and Lilly Endowment. I know that's often a source of confusion. And then tell us what exactly you're going to be doing in the areas you outline in your speech, education, the economy, and health across the world where you're active with your philanthropy.
Yeah, thank you, Claire. Yeah, so first, Lilly Endowment, Lilly Company. And so the company has a foundation, which is our philanthropic arm. Separately, the endowment, it was a gift from the family members, the son and grandsons of the founder, with their stock, which is a separate entity completely. They still own a lot of stock, so we pay attention to them, but their philanthropic efforts are different than ours.
Okay.
So what are we trying to do? I think, you know, over the years, as a big company in a medium-sized city, our philanthropic efforts have taken on a broad front of activities. And I think as we've thought more and more about this, we've tried to focus that. So while there are many organizations that need and want our support, and they're good causes, I think we're asking questions about what can make the long term the biggest difference for our community and our company. What do we have a specific expertise in where we can be smart about how we use philanthropic strategy to bring around real social change? So it is those three areas you mentioned. In healthcare, we, for many years, going back to Sydney's time, had a global health set of initiatives to improve healthcare in a number of markets. Typically, we've targeted these at low-income countries, and it started with our tuberculosis, anti-tuberculosis efforts, which is a significant problem in big countries like India, China, Russia. And Lilly had some medicines that came from research many, many years ago that actually as a cocktail tended to work pretty well. So we built a set of initiatives around that. We were pretty successful. And so in 2008 and 2009, we asked ourselves, well, should we keep going with this or change it? We moved to what we call non-communicable diseases, really focused on diabetes primarily. And we've actually run a number of projects like the one we announced earlier this week in Mexico, in India, et cetera. And it then occurred to us several years ago, particularly in the middle of the Affordable Care Act debate, why aren't we running something like this in the U.S.? There are also health disparities here. So this week's announcement is the culmination of that work, and we're proud to partner with IU Fairbanks and Eskenazi on this one.
Great. Well, we look forward to seeing the impact of that work over the next 5 years, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. There was a question on Twitter, which was kind of a throwback for it. I worked at Lilly over 12 years ago, but a book from one of your predecessors, Mr. Tobias, that he wrote a book called Put the Moose on the Table.
I've read it.
Yeah. So the question was all the changes that you're grappling with now and how you're trying to lead the company to deal well with the changes that it's facing both within the company and outside of the company. How would you characterize the culture and what are some changes that might be going on within the walls of Lilly to help you be ready for the future?
Yeah, well, there's some interesting parallels. You know, Randy took over the company when there was a lot of problems, but also a lot of promise in the labs. I think his insights of really putting the moose on the table, which is his way of saying, let's talk clearly about those challenges. He wanted to globalize the company, and he wanted to focus it on fewer therapy areas where we can make the biggest difference. Those themes are still with us, actually. We are a global company. We want to be focused on a few therapy areas, and we definitely want to be a company where we're not beating around the bush. We're addressing problems squarely. I've tried to focus us on a few other things on top of that, culturally, and we're very much in the early phases of this, but I like the progress we're seeing so far. The first and most important one is speed and agility, and I mentioned that in the talk. The world is speeding up. We're a big company. We're not naturally fast. Although we, I think, have deeply benefited from being based in the Midwest. Most of our peers aren't here. In fact, none of them are in Indiana. And so you can lose touch. And I think particularly when you're growing, and you know, we grew revenue 9% in Q1, earnings over 30%, it's easy to have some hubris and lose connection with what the best are doing right now. So that's an external focus that I'd also like to inject in our culture. So moving faster, being more externally oriented. The final one is using scale where it matters. So Lilly's a big company. I think everyone probably in this room would say, yeah, you're a big company. Biggest private company in Indiana. But we're actually the 14th largest drug company. Mm-hmm. We're not a big company in our sector. So it can't be that by dividing ourselves into parts, we get stronger. It has to be that working more closely together, we can be stronger. So that's something else we're putting in the culture, is put the corporate mission first and really act as one. Use our scale as strength where we can.
I want to turn now to your call out to us on STEM and having a strategy for the state, where you said, I think it was STEM in every classroom every day.
Yes.
Tell us why Lilly has been such a long time investor from a private initiative standpoint in STEM, and why you think that it really has to be the state leading. And then also for the folks in this room who work in the private sector or at universities, what role can they play in helping create a really great strategy and helping with implementation?
Right. Yeah, we feel strongly about this. Some of it's self-serving, right? We still hire a little more than half our employees from the state who grew up here. And so the quality of our workforce is direct reflection of the quality of the K through 12 system, and in also many of our secondary schools. And so if we don't have enough local talent, that's a problem for us. It is harder to recruit from other areas. We can do it, but it takes more effort. So there is that component. But also, you know, we worry about the competitiveness of the region. And maybe some people debate whether having a STEM-based curriculum throughout one's elementary and high school training is important. We don't really debate that. It seems self-evident at this point. The future is about technology. We need to prepare people for careers in these fields. And that can't happen your freshman year in college. You have to start very early in life. So that's why we feel strongly about it. We've done a lot of things. We've got 4,000 PhD scientists down at our headquarters who would love to volunteer and do. We have run many programs. These are all wrapping around a current system, though, that isn't built to produce STEM-ready graduates. Mm-hmm. So that's really where we're focused. I think that everyone can get involved in this civically. I think the Department of Education needs to be the natural convener here, though, because their role is to establish these standards statewide. Mm-hmm. And so we should talk to them and let them know what we need as employers.
Great. Well, I've got one last question for you. You're the leader of an almost $23 billion company. You're obviously a well-equipped, accomplished leader. It would be great for you to give some advice to emerging and established leaders in this room about what you think are traits of great leadership and how can we all improve upon our leadership in our organizations to take our own organizations to the next level.
Yeah, it's a complex question. I'll try to answer it in a few minutes. I met some IU undergrads who approached me earlier today. That's a good start. I think it's a people business. Everything's a people business. So you coming to things like this is making yourself aware, and meeting new people is a key thing. You know, I think that the things that have led to success, and I know many other CEOs, there aren't really common paths, and there aren't really common backgrounds, but there are some common traits. I think people who have a real passion for what they're doing matters. Most of work is just that, it's work. It's not all glamorous speeches to big crowds. So you better enjoy it, even when it's hard. And I think that's a key success factor for sustaining effort over a long period of time. Another thing I would say is adaptability and learning. So, you know, if you're all your learning occurred in the degrees that go after your title, you're not going to go very far. The world is changing. I've learned much more in a year and a half of CEO as I did in my MBA. It's on the job all the time, and I think having that growth mindset is critical. And then, you know, finally, there's not a lot of substitute for taking on tough problems and working to solve them. I don't think you can finesse your way to the top. I think you have to be in the core of the business working on things that matter to that enterprise's long-term success. I encourage people always to stay in the mainstream of what a company is about. That's how you learn the most. That's how you contribute. That's how you get noticed.
Well, thank you for your time today. Thank you for your leadership at Lilly, and thank you for all that Lilly does for the state of Indiana. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to David Ricks, Chairman and CEO of Eli Lilly and Company, concluding the 2017-2018 Economic Club Speaker Series. The 2018-2019 Speaker Series will be announced soon at economicclubofindiana.com. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.